Hello there, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Perry. I'm your Sun Sounds reader today. I'm going to be reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic, all of them published in August of 2026. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this apropos article, The 108-Degree Eviction. Living outside is a more dreadful prospect during a heat wave. By Meg Bernhard. On any other day, when the high was forecast to be 108 degrees, Susie Tyson would not have left her Las Vegas apartment. The stroke she'd had at 30 made her sensitive to the heat, she found. At 67, going out during Nevada's hottest months would make her dizzy, nauseous, and, in her words, hurting everywhere. But on June 17th, she had no choice. That morning, a Clark County constable came to evict her and her daughter Shelby from the apartment they'd lived in for nearly 20 years. The three-bedroom unit was a stuccoed two-story building, the generic type found in suburban Vegas's gated complexes, with a spindly olive tree out front. In the summer, they cloistered the place, hanging blankets over their blinds to make the apartment darker and save on the energy bill. Sometimes they skimped on air conditioning. Susie and Shelby had wanted to stay in their apartment and had cleared their clutter enough to pass a housing authority inspection in June. But that month, their landlord had terminated their lease, saying they'd violated it by leaving the apartment in disrepair and letting their personal property become a fire hazard. During the weeks that followed the eviction, Susie and Shelby scrambled to find housing, trying not to think about their worst-case scenario, that they could be forced to live outside during a heat wave. In Las Vegas, heat is the backstory to every summer. It kills car batteries, skyrockets energy bills, makes steering wheels hot to the touch. Heat can make a good day bad, and a bad day worse for anyone, but some people bear more of its burden than others. For people who are old, or work outside, or don't have a stable place to live, the heat is particularly dangerous. When a person's core temperature gets too hot, their organs can fail, and they can go into cardiac arrest. In recent summers in Vegas, hundreds of deaths have been attributed to heat. One study found that in recent years, half of all deaths of homeless people in this county were heat-related. People have lived in the area that's now Las Vegas for thousands of years, but only the past century have they lived like this, tethered to air conditioning, reliant on year-round shelter. The increasing temperatures threaten to render the city inhospitable. The summer of 2024, which featured one record-breaking 120-degree day, was the city's hottest ever, and about 400 people in Clark County died of heat-related illness. In mid-July, when Susie and Shelby had run out of money to pay for the weekly rental where they'd moored themselves for the time being, the temperatures were ticking up to 114 degrees. They could handle the heat or the housing uncertainty, but facing both stresses at once felt impossible. An urgent question loomed. In the middle of a Las Vegas summer, where would they go? This city was not Susie's first choice of hometown. Originally from Buffalo, New York, she had lived in California and Oregon before she landed in Las Vegas. Her brother was here, her parents were coming, and she could use childcare help after leaving her husband. The stroke had made her right side weak, and in combination with back issues and a degenerative disc disease, made it necessary to use a cane. She couldn't work much, and her health issues made driving difficult. In a place where a single errand might send a person a dozen or more miles from home. Immediately after the eviction, Susie had Ubered to a hospital. The heat and stress had made her sick. Then she Ubered to Arizona Charlie's, a casino hotel 10 miles from the apartment, where she and Shelby stayed 6 nights and paid about $50 for each one. After bouncing for 4 more nights between 2 other casinos, they ended up in Siegel Suites, a weekly rental studio, the cheapest option they could find. Even that cost them $1,000 a month more than the rent they had been paying. The studio was also more than an hour's journey via rideshares and buses to the Macy's and Target, where Shelby, who's 32, worked part-time, and more than 20 miles from their old apartment. According to Nevada law, they had 30 days to collect any belongings remaining there. On an oppressive July morning, Susie and Shelby took an $8 Lyft to a U-Haul facility near the weekly rental, where they met up with Mia Kells, a woman from a local mutual aid Facebook group. Susie's parents and brother had died years earlier, and without family to help, she and Shelby had enlisted Kells as a driver. Susie was talkative and apologetic and quick to smile. Shelby was quiet and firm. During the school year, Shelby taught as a substitute teacher in the Clark County School District and had recently started a bachelor's degree in early childhood education on a scholarship. The two were close. So close, Susie said, that the radio psychic, Gary Spivey, once told them they were bound together in a past life. But in that reality, Shelby was the mother and Susie was the daughter. In this life, Shelby was Susie's primary caregiver, helping her walk and sometimes dressing her. They were rarely apart. Even with air conditioning, their apartment was stuffy inside. As they sorted through cups, coats, Christmas ornaments, dresses, dolls, DVDs, makeup, and old schoolwork, they moved with a detached sense of purpose, their apartment of 2 decades no longer feeling like home. In anticipation of the eviction, they'd found a new apartment close to Shelby's retail jobs. But now they'd lost their housing voucher. Public housing programs can revoke assistance after lease violations, and couldn't afford the rent. Susie collapsed into the couch to sip water. She was winded, and the small fans she'd plugged into the wall were still. "The air doesn't even seem to be working," Shelby said. She too suffered in the heat, especially when her legs swelled and she couldn't wear the knee braces that helped her manage the pain of her scoliosis. "I'm melting, literally. I'm sweating," Susie said. By 1 p.m., it was 107 outside. "It felt," said Kells, "like 107 inside." Their faces were shimmering and flushed, and the mood was grim. This was just the beginning of a week of accounting and logistics, during which they would attempt to reinstate the housing voucher and request a social services payment to cover housing in the next weeks. Their costs were mounting, and the 10 nights in casino hotels, along with the weekly rental, paid only through July 18th, had used up Susie's monthly disability and Social Security checks. At one point, after they'd trekked to the Regional Housing Authority, then been sent to a legal aid office, an aid worker from another group called to say they'd been approved for temporary housing, if they could be ready within 2 hours. But getting back to the rental they'd just paid for and packing up everything they'd be able to bring seemed too tall an order. A few days later, their best chance of staying even in temporary housing was a friend from social media who had offered to pay for an extra week in the Siegel Suites, Susie said, but the friend's payment wasn't going through. Susie and Shelby took a paratransit bus one last time to the old apartment to gather jewelry, clothing, and a few pieces of family memorabilia. They couldn't take anything else. "Doesn't it feel strange to even be here now?" Susie asked Shelby. A little after 1 p.m., a staffer for the complex locked the apartment. It was 106 degrees out. 2 days later, the heat had broken. The temperature was in the 90s. Shelby took a $9 Uber to a bus stop so that she was 40 minutes early. Sometimes the buses came early, too. In the sky, dark clouds were billowing. The summer monsoon season promised some measure of relief. When the bus arrived, Shelby took a seat near the front. The bus passed her middle school, then the strip, and then, more than an hour into the trip, climbed to the wealthier area of town, Summerlin, where she worked. After the exertion of the week, her mother was unable to stand for more than 5 minutes before her back started hurting, a stabbing pain. Still, Shelby was feeling hopeful, at least about the next couple of weeks. The online friend's payment had gone through, so they could stay at Siegel Suites through July 25th. Using a payment plan, $40 a month for 12 months, Shelby reserved the studio until August 1st. When Susie received her monthly disability payment, they could use that check to pay for a few more weeks and hope to sort out the housing voucher before running out of money again. Shelby arrived at the mall before her shift started and looked for a place to do her homework. School took her mind off things. She chose a seat in the outdoor plaza. The more forgiving temperatures didn't change the fact that she and her mother were still unhoused, nor did it change the long-term outlook for Las Vegas. The city was in drought, and Lake Mead, the reservoir that fed the city, along with millions of other people in Arizona, California, and Mexico, were projected to hit a record low within a month. Most people in Las Vegas could avoid the heat by hunkering down in air-conditioned cars and air-conditioned buildings, but low lake levels could threaten the power supply of much of the Southwest and the region's water supply, too. Drought is hard to escape. The next day, July 18th, Shelby and her mother would celebrate Shelby's recent birthday by seeing Ed Sheeran at Allegiant Stadium. They'd bought the tickets back in October on payments before they were worried about eviction. When she was younger, her mother had made a habit of calling into radio programs in order to win concert tickets, restaurant gift cards, even a cruise to Ensenada. This would be their first concert in ages. It was difficult to think much further ahead than that. And that completes the first article. The author, Meg Bernhard, is a freelance writer based in Las Vegas, Nevada. She's written for the New York Times Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, and the New Yorker. The name of her article was The 108 Degree Eviction. The next article is titled, If Only This Could Last Forever. Summer is the worst season of all, and also the most beautiful, by Elizabeth Brunig. Summer always overstays its welcome by about a month. After the 4th of July, which has its charms, nothing but a stretch of relentless heat lies ahead, reaching toward Labor Day, and I begin to yearn for fall. So does the grand, semi-malevolent intelligence that organizes American consumption. By mid-August, grocery stores are stocking their shelves with autumnal goods: pumpkin pie Pop-Tarts, cinnamon maple Frosted Flakes, pumpkin spice cinnamon rolls in pressurized cardboard tubes. As I stroll through the aisles, I gaze wistfully at candy corn while the frosty supermarket air cools the sweat I worked up walking to the store beneath the blazing sun. Late September can't arrive soon enough. The summer has been especially hot, worse than most years. Heat waves killed at least 14,000 people in Europe. Parts of France recorded 110-degree temperatures in June. Wildfires raged across North America, torching more than 4.5 million acres in Canada and parts of the United States, and forcing 60,000 people to evacuate their homes. The Canadian fires sent heavy smoke billowing over the Northeast, coloring the sky, contaminating the air, and forcing all activities indoors. The warming climate has brought too many ticks and a 10 to 15% rise in mosquitoes, along with raised red welts and transmitted viruses. All of this was on my mind as I slathered my children with insect repellent and sunscreen before sending them off to local playgrounds, half consumed by green overgrowth, poison ivy lurking among the leaves. Still, no amount of well-intended prophylaxis stands a chance against little hands and streams of sweat. The season comes with a chaotic flurry of activity as the last school bell gives way to day camps, sleepaway camps, and hastily cobbled together childcare, spread out with luck among family and friends. Unwieldy arrangements that cost the average parent thousands of dollars a year. My two daughters arrive home from day camp hours before the workday is done, with dirt on their knees and popsicle sticks between their teeth. I scramble to squeeze in snacks and entertainment between sentences. Peanut butter and jelly crackers here, a paint-by-numbers kit there, both kids as bored as I am busy. The front yard is apparently too flat to supply sufficient fun on the slip-and-slide, though my daughters will shell scoot violently on it when the afternoon grows too monotonous. I hose the grass off their feet and lay down towels before they come back inside, then stay up late doing dishes and laundry after they go to bed. Another item of business. Both children have summer birthdays, and the pressure of whipping up summertime birthday parties can be enormous. Convening dozens of children during vacation season takes some wrangling. This year I packed 26 piping bags of icing in a rainbow of pastel colors and made tiny cakes for one daughter and her friends to decorate while seated at long folding tables on the back patio. I also lugged a helium tank and bags of banners, tablecloths, hats, and balloons to the ice skating rink, and nervously prayed that enough kids would show up to satisfy my other daughter. It all transpired smoothly in the end, and then I found myself with cake crumbs on my shorts and a 10-year-old and 7-year-old wondering where the time had gone. Summer drags on, but then feels fleeting. It's hard not to experience a certain nostalgia for the moments as they pass. Still, one works up a sweat managing the hours, such that it comes as something of a relief when the kids abscond to sleepaway camp for a couple of weeks, or to the beach with Grandma and Grandpa for a little while. The house is clean and quiet, and the work gets done. I comb through their old clothes, folding the old ones into donation bags to make room for back-to-school outfits that are one or two sizes larger than last year's. But there are still a few weeks of summer left when they come home, and though there are dishes in the sink, mud tracks on the floor, and deadlines to meet, I join them on their adventures. We sail across the New York Harbor by ferry to Governor's Island, a kid's oasis where the fresh waters of the Hudson River stream into the salty Atlantic Ocean. There are food trucks, ice cream stands, enormous slides, and a massive junkyard playground where kids can splatter paint across scrap wood and mount precariously assembled tire forts. It is hot, searing hot, but what I see when I squint through the sweat is resplendent. Kids climbing the structure of their own worlds. My two daughters are golden-skinned, with sun-bleached braids. Their fine, downy body hair catches the light, lending them an ethereal glow. They look like young gods in the summertime of their lives. This season is their season. The junkyard play feels a little dangerous, but it's their beauty, not their vulnerability, that transfixes me. When night comes, I help them ignite leftover sparklers, which illuminate their faces with silvery starlight. Fall arrives like a fever breaking. Mayhem gives way to order, and adventures give way to routines. A cool calmness presides over suburbia, and as I heave heavy pumpkins into my cart at Costco, I know that I will soon get what I have eagerly anticipated: darkness and quiet, discipline and fruitful maturity. I will clock out of work for the day just as the children arrive home from school, hang their backpacks by the door, and huddle around the kitchen table. They will have spent their day learning new skills and new social norms, developing their friendships and knowledge of the world. All of this will change them, subtly but certainly. At these ages, they are constantly being reborn. They still need me to help them with their homework, and they still need me to serve them dinner as the evening proceeds. But they will need me less than they did last year, and next year even less. And as I watch them diligently spell out answers on their worksheets, I will wish that summer had lasted forever. And that completes the article, "If Only This Could Last Forever," by Atlantic staff writer Elizabeth Brunig. I'm going to take just a moment out of the broadcast to remind any of you that have tuned in late, you're listening to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds reader today. I'm reading articles from the online edition of the magazine. Continuing on with this article titled, "Trump is Asking the Private Sector to Save Him." Piecemeal price cuts won't solve the Iran war's effects on inflation, by Will Gottsiegen. At this year's annual meeting of the World Economic Forum, Donald Trump told a room full of the world's most prominent CEOs about a routine that he performs when he meets a successful business person. I say, "Congratulations." They say, "On what?" I said, "You've doubled your net worth since I've been president, right?" This is how Trump has long pitched himself, as the savior of American commerce. One of his central promises to voters in 2024 was that he would encourage private investment in the United States, boosting the stock market and ushering in a golden age of economic activity. Everyone, he vowed, would be making money. But the president now seems less pro-business than he once did. On Monday, in response to a question about the gargantuan profits being posted by U.S. oil companies, Trump told reporters that ExxonMobil and Chevron are, quote, "making too much money based on a shortage," end quote. Energy companies adjust their prices as global markets move. When Trump took the country to war against Iran in February, the world's oil supply was abruptly pinched and prices shot up. Chevron and ExxonMobil announced that they'd earned $12.1 billion and $14.5 billion, respectively, last quarter, many billions more than they'd made during the same period last year. They ought to give some of that back to the public, and they better cut the retail price, the consumer price, Trump said. This statement echoes the president's previous accusation of price gouging in the industry. Back in June, after the U.S. and Iran signed a memorandum of understanding, Trump claimed that companies were keeping gas prices from falling as quickly as oil prices were. There are legitimate economic reasons that gas prices and oil prices aren't perfectly synced, and big oil doesn't unilaterally set retail gas prices at American pumps. Fewer than 5% of U.S. gas stations are owned directly by major oil companies, according to the American Petroleum Institute. The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission subsequently called for states to investigate possible retail price manipulation. To shift some of the responsibility for high gas prices, the president is now scolding an industry he once championed. But it won't change the reality that most Americans are unhappy with the economy and that Trump is largely to blame. Oil interests reportedly spent more than $75 million to get Trump reelected, and the administration has consistently supported the industry over the past 2 years. Drill, baby, drill has been a mantra for his administration since day one. The White House recently revoked protections for endangered species, clearing the way for companies to drill in critical wildlife habitats. The Secretary of the Interior, Doug Burgum, has pushed to increase offshore drilling and drilling on public lands. Trump's suggestion that big oil return some of its money to the public represents, by his own admission, a hard pivot. I should be the last one to say it, because I'm a big free enterprise guy. Nobody bigger, he said on Monday. ExxonMobil declined to comment for this story. Chevron didn't respond to my request, and the White House told me that President Trump's priority has always been and continues to be lowering gas prices for American families. The Trump administration has made a point of celebrating businesses that have cut costs for consumers in recent months. In July, Trump applauded a new chain of gas stations called the Freedom Fuel Network for selling gas at a discount across the Mid-Atlantic. On Truth Social, the president wrote that this very smart retailer was stepping up on account of its patriotism, and that others should follow its example. Brooke Rollins, the agriculture secretary, wrote on X yesterday that a co-owner of 14 Piggly Wiggly supermarkets, who has been invited to the Oval Office in the past, was answering Trump's call by boldly stepping up to lower costs for families. She praised Walmart for implementing similar price-cutting measures and wrote a few days ago that another grocer, Meijer, was also answering the call by lowering prices on more than 1,000 items. But it's unclear whether these companies' discounts were actually responses to the president, as Rollins has suggested. Trump and his party have every reason to be worried about high prices. All kinds of consumer goods have become more expensive since the start of the Iran war, and Americans are now broadly worried about the cost of living, just as they were before Trump took office. People's dissatisfaction with the president's handling of the economy is reflected in his abysmal approval ratings, which pose a problem for Republicans in the midterms. Trump's strategy has so far been to avoid taking any responsibility for any Iran-driven inflation, and to insist that, actually, the U.S. is experiencing an economic boom. He's right that some indicators have lately been positive. The stock market continues to set record highs, and inflation did cool in June after three straight months of acceleration, although it's still higher than it was before the start of the war. With his comments on big oil, the president seems to be acknowledging that high prices are indeed a problem for many Americans. He also seems to expect that private companies will bail him out during a moment of political weakness. This administration has created the conditions, both domestically and abroad, for consumer goods to become more expensive and for the cost of oil to jump. No piecemeal discount can undo what Trump himself has already done. And that completes the article, Trump is Asking the Private Sector to Save Him, by Atlantic staff writer Will Gottsiegen. This next article is titled, The Human Origin Story is Being Radically Revised. New secrets from our past have been coming out in droves, by Ross Anderson. Some 50,000 years ago, modern humans wandered into Ice Age Europe. The continent was new to us Homo sapiens, but not for beings of our general kind. Neanderthals and their ancestors had been living among Eurasia's glaciers for ages, and in ways that would have struck us as familiar. Evidence suggests that they may have strung eagle talons together into necklaces and stained their bodily ornaments with pigments. They tended fires, cooked food, and maybe even made their own glue. On sandstone cave walls, they etched wavy lines, dots, and other geometric designs. After first contact, under social circumstances that we cannot possibly imagine, modern humans and Neanderthals had children together. Around the same time in Asia, our species also procreated with another species, the Denisovans. Scientists know this because they have sequenced DNA from Neanderthal and Denisovan remains, and they can see fragments of their code in our genomes to this day. Now we are learning that still more of these fusions of blood and culture may have shaped our lineage. Last week, a team of researchers from UC Berkeley and Johns Hopkins University published new evidence in Science suggesting that two ghost ancestors haunt our family tree. Not Neanderthals or Denisovans, but some other hominin populations. DNA analysis is only one of the techniques that scientists have been using to cast narrow shafts of light into the dark abyss that is the human past. Researchers from several disciplines have been collecting and reinterpreting ever smaller traces of our forebears to reimagine how they lived, what they made, and what family secrets they might still be hiding. The Ghost Ancestors paper is the most recent example. The team from UC Berkeley and Hopkins analyzed some very odd sequences of DNA in the human genome, which were discovered 20 years ago. These don't match up with those of any ancient hominin species that have already been sequenced, and their origins have been mysterious. But now we have some suspects. One of the strange sequences appears to come from a hominin who mated with us before we ventured out of Africa. The other may come from the great wanderer Homo erectus, who left Africa nearly 2 million years ago and ranged across Asia. Homo erectus may never have encountered Homo sapiens directly, but the researchers suspect that the hominin interbred with the Denisovans before the Denisovans interbred with us. Either way, all of these people, if it is right to call them people, played a role in our species' story of becoming, yet we are only now learning the nature of that connection. All year, scientists from different fields have been making revisions to the human origin story. In January, one team announced that they'd found handheld wooden tools along an ancient lakeshore in present-day Greece, a refuge between glaciers where hominins of some kind butchered elephants about 430,000 years ago. These are surely not the first wooden tools ever to be made, but they are the most ancient that we've managed to find, and they were used during the Stone Age. That name, Stone Age, is misleading. It reveals more about the people who lived through the period, who may not have thought of themselves as being defined by stone tools at all. We perceive them that way only because their napped axes of flint and obsidian are likelier to have survived to the present day than the digging sticks that our forebears smoothed and sharpened. Beyond stone and wood, these lakeside elephant butchers likely put all kinds of natural materials to clever use. They may have employed woven twine to sew animal hides together, but we wouldn't know it because twine unravels into thin, disintegrating filaments, and bacteria rapidly remove hides from the world. Wood tends to rot away too. In this location, the tools had the good geological fortune to be buried quickly under mud. Stone tools have themselves been reinterpreted. Researchers recently detected traces of poison on an ancient set of quartz arrowheads that were dug up in 1985. The weapons were found in a South African rock shelter that was used by modern humans 60,000 years ago, tens of thousands of years earlier than what had been regarded as the oldest confirmed human use of poison. The ancient South African archers retrieved the neurotoxin from a plant bulb that grows as large as a honeydew melon and dabbed it onto the cold stone of their arrowheads, knowing that it would slow down any animal that they pierced. Some scientists are now calling for a reappraisal of other ancient arrowheads to see whether they too had been sheathed in poison by people whose ingenuity had previously been underestimated by science. Piecing together the history of our species in this way is tedious work because the evidence is so fragmentary. The Earth's violent, self-renewing processes erase so much. During the planet's cold spells, its glaciers steamroll from the poles toward the equator, grinding and scraping whole land masses clean. In its warmer middle zones, jungles can sprout up within decades, covering human ruins in a thick and devouring layer of green. Scientists have recently learned that the Amazon rainforest has been concealing millennia-old earthworks on an enormous scale. A team of international researchers spent weeks flying lighter-equipped planes back and forth over a swath of Amazonia. Their laser scans revealed nearly 400 immense structures that were previously unknown to science. From the sky, they saw that these systems of raised banks and deep ditches formed geometrically precise circles, octagons, and squares, and were linked to one another by remarkably straight roads. The earthworks were built 1,200 to 2,500 years ago by the Aquiri civilization. Having surveyed only one small portion of a query territory, the researchers suspect that tens of thousands more of these structures may be waiting silently under the region's trees. 100,000 years from now, the Aquari ruins might vanish altogether, and in Earth time, 100,000 years is nothing. In 10 million years, even the skyscrapers and continent-sprawling infrastructure of our own civilization will be crushed into sedimentary layers. Nearly everything that we have created will be reduced to trace elements and isotopes, but for a few specimens lucky enough to be fossilized. For all the other details of our world to persist in human memory, science would need to get better, or civilization itself would need to keep existing and telling its own story from now until then. And that completes the article. The Human Origin Story is Being Radically Revised by staff writer Ross Anderson. This next article is titled, Hindsight is 2024. Some institutions jumped onto the MAGA bandwagon after the 2024 election, but it hasn't taken long for those decisions to look short-sighted. It's by staff writer David A. Graham. When Donald Trump returned to the White House in 2025, he was nursing grudges and claiming a mandate. The institution he saw as his enemies in politics, business, and education faced a dilemma about how to respond. A few concluded that they should resist the president's demands of fealty and collaboration. Another group tried appeasement, seeking accommodation that would allow them to otherwise operate as usual. And some looked at the landscape and concluded that something fundamental had shifted in American politics. They saw the MAGA movement as a lasting change and decided that their best move was to make their own radical shift to adjust. As I wrote last week, predictions of a Trump-driven realignment of the electorate now look extremely shaky. The groups that he was able to attract to the Republican ticket 2 years ago, young voters, especially men, Hispanic voters and black men, have turned solidly against him and against GOP candidates in polls ahead of the midterms. Voters who were unimpressed with Joe Biden or Kamala Harris and who heard Trump's promise of stopping inflation are now angry about the president's shrugging at higher prices and inflationary war in Iran. With some distance, the 2024 election looks less like a decisive turning point and more like a fluke. But that realization has come too late for those who reshaped themselves for a reality that has proved ephemeral. David Ellison, who alongside with his father Larry is a friend of Trump's, decided to use the new Trump administration as an opportunity to build a huge media conglomerate. First, his company, Skydance, merged with Paramount. Taking control of CBS News, he installed Barry Weiss as editor-in-chief, seeking a leader who would appeal more to both the White House and to conservative viewers. But Weiss's makeover has so far looked like a flop. 60 Minutes has hemorrhaged staffers, and the evening news has hemorrhaged viewers. Her proposition was that a slightly more conservative version of the mainstream media would bring the audience back to a struggling network. But that doesn't appear to actually be appealing to either MAGA viewers or legacy CBS watchers. Ellison has already moved on to an attempted merger with Warner Brothers, reportedly promising administration officials deep political changes at CNN if the deal was approved by federal regulators. Ellison got approval, but now that deal is in trouble anyway. Facing an antitrust lawsuit led by the Attorney General of California, Paramount agreed to pause the merger until a trial next year. Experts are divided on how likely Paramount is to prevail. But if the merger doesn't close by September 30th, the company will owe Warner Brothers shareholders $7 million every day until it does. In a New York Times column last week, Ellison complained that people are drawing incorrect inferences about his politics, but his private views are beside the point. What is public is Ellison's willingness to play to the Trump administration's politics to build an empire. CBS News is not the only media interest to discover that courting MAGA news consumers is not a guarantee of success or growth. The Times also reported recently on how a range of right-wing influencers has seen audiences shrink drastically. Their travails appear to reflect Trump's own difficulty in keeping his 2024 coalition together. The most pro-Trump figures have seen some of the biggest drops amid ideological battles inside the MAGA coalition over Israel and the war in Iran, while more Trump-critical figures on the right have sometimes gained. Other corporate leaders also bet on Trump. Elon Musk attempted to become something like an unelected deputy president at the start of Trump's second term. That experiment ended acrimoniously, and the men's relationship has been on and off ever since. But Musk's reputation is now inextricably connected with Trump's. X has shed users, Tesla sales have struggled, in part because anti-Trump consumers have turned against Musk, and also because Musk has been distracted by other ventures, such as SpaceX. These decisions to throw in with Trump were notable because many institutions treated his 2016 win as an accident of chance and were happy to publicly resist him. In doing so, though, they seem to have opened the door to more direct corporate involvement in politics, and with it, greater vulnerability to political pressure. The idea that corporations had gone woke by embracing DEI and other progressive causes in 2020 and 2021 was to some extent a marketing ploy by the companies, but it infuriated Republicans and made them targets for Trump's second administration. Trying to protect themselves, corporate leaders now may have overcorrected, mistakenly assuming a lasting MAGA regime. Within right-wing politics, many individuals and organizations also leapt into Trumpism. The Venerable Heritage Foundation reworked itself and lost or pushed out many long-standing scholars and staffers. Now it finds itself in an identity crisis and also shut out the White House because Trump is still sore about the attention and credit that Project 2025 won for driving his agenda. Many mainstream Republicans remade themselves as MAGA Republicans, but the results have not always been good. Just ask Senator John Cronin, who lost his primary to an even more MAGA challenger this May. Earlier this month, Politico's Kathy Gilsannon reported on the broken pipeline for bringing new foot soldiers into conservative government and nonprofit organizations. Everyone knows what the problem is. The organizations that bring young staffers to Washington, D.C. have spent the last decade prioritizing blind ideological loyalty instead of competence or intelligence. A senior GOP congressional staffer told her, "We have a generation of rabid, incompetent idiots." This is the risk of betting big on a long-term realignment. If you wager wrong, politics overall will snap back quickly, but you will be stuck with the consequences of your decision for much longer. And that completes the article. The title was Hindsight is 2024 by Atlantic staff writer David A. Graham. I'll close out the broadcast today with some of the letters to the Atlantic, all under the title The Key to Understanding the Traditionalists. History is running backwards. In the May issue, David Brooks considered why reactionaries are taking over the world. And here are some of the letters. "History is running backwards" is a provocative article, but I think David Brooks errs in framing traditionalism and modernity as an either-or, when in fact they exist in a both-and context. One can be both a traditionalist and a modernist simultaneously. The key, as Brooks notes, is that a well-adjusted life consisted of daring explorations from a secure base. Would that we all were so blessed to have that. That comes from Judy Cottrell of Eugene, Oregon. This in from Alan Francis, M.D. from Carmel, California. "In dividing humanity into two neat psychological types, stability-seeking traditionalists and novelty-seeking progressives, Brooks misses an essential point. Psychology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It constantly interacts with changing social factors. People who not long ago may have readily switched jobs and moved cities are now more likely to stay in place because of the scarcity of new positions and the lack of affordable housing. Their psychology didn't change, their circumstances did. Our ancestors, who ventured out of Africa 1.9 million years ago, were likely seeking their next meal, not the thrill of adventure. These days, people are liable to deny science and seek safety in traditional institutions because the grandest creation of modern technology, artificial intelligence, threatens everything about our way of life. Debates should focus not on psychological insecurity, but on the technological, economic, and political decisions that are fostering material uncertainty and pushing people to cling to a much safer past." The next letter comes from Thomas Thurston of Rosarito, Mexico. "The fact that the traditionalists, whom Brooks discusses, cannot even agree on when humanity's fall occurred, should raise doubts about their ideology. What they are constructing is less history than creation myth. As in the story of Adam and Eve, the fall occurs when people begin thinking for themselves. History and science teach us that there never was an Eden of perfect human harmony. Civilization was built painfully, and by most measurable standards, life today is far better than it was in the past." The key to understanding the traditionalists is analyzing not the past they claim to describe, but the present in which their appeals are gaining traction. Their movement has emerged as society has granted more rights to previously marginalized groups. Beneath the traditionalist arguments lies a recurring sentiment. My group once had the authority to define how society should function, and now it no longer does. If only people would stop questioning inherited traditions and defer once again to established authority, as defined by my group, then society could recover its lost harmony. Brooks suggests that cultivating a sense of rootedness might help blunt the traditionalist appeal, but many Americans do not see themselves reflected in what passes for American tradition. Our society does not make it easy for them to feel rooted. They do not see people like themselves in the literature or history they study. We need to develop broader narratives that tell the country's whole story. That, in turn, can cultivate a broader sense of belonging. The humanities do need revival, as Brooks argues, but they should not be organized around a myth of decline. They should be grounded instead in the founding principles that all people are created equal and possess unalienable rights. The continuing struggle to realize these ideals could provide the shared civic story in which all Americans might find roots. And with that, we have run out of time for the broadcast today. You've been listening to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program today, and I hope you found it informative. I've been reading from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. All of the articles were dated in August of 2026. Stay safe, stay well, and have a wonderful week. And thank you so much for spending your time with me today.